Okay, let's get started, shall we? I'm always fascinated by the sparse layout of the audience in a technical session where people choose to sit like right in front of the speaker. Nobody wants to sit. I don't know why. I do spit a little, but it's not as bad as someone like Steve Ballmer, who spits a lot when he talks. I don't know if you've heard. I could talk about him. He doesn't work here anymore. Welcome. I'm going to talk about IoT today. I hope you all are interested in talking about IoT as well, and you're in the right place. How many of you, just a show of hands, attended Uli Hohman's session earlier? Handful of folks. So Uli focused on the cloud stuff, and today I thought I would focus on all the client-side stuff, like how do you build devices on top of Windows and some of our runtimes. And so I've got a ton of demos to show you guys. In fact, after the session, if you want to take a peek at what I've constructed here, I only had like a half an hour to get all this set up, and it's a lot of cords. One day, a wireless future will make all of this better. We'll have wireless power and wireless this and wireless that. But today, there are a lot of cords. And so hopefully the demos go well, but if not, we'll at least have a lot of fun when they crash. Let me start off with just a little bit of level setting, because I do think that IoT is not a new thing. We talk about IoT like it's a new thing. But in fact, probably a lot of you here in the audience today have been working on IoT-like stuff for a long time, either embedded systems or devices that generate data that feed up into some server somewhere, into some database somewhere, that then you can, you know, do insight on top of that data and make a business run more efficiently. Like, that's not new. But the reason why IoT is getting a lot of interest and attention is because there are some things about this space that are new. And I call a few out here. Probably one of the biggest is cost. It is getting so inexpensive to produce devices, to produce components. You could even argue, if you just kind of mathematically looked at the curve, that the cost of hardware is asymptotically approaching zero. Like, literally, hardware costs are going lower, lower, lower. Just makes it easier to build cool stuff. At the same time, connectivity, which was once a very expensive and precious commodity to get connectivity at any reasonable bandwidth, is becoming pervasive with 3G, 4G, Wi-Fi, and then lots of different local protocols, Bluetooth, 6LoWPAN, et cetera. It's easier and easier to get devices connected both with one another in some local area, but also with the cloud, and to be able to provide services that these devices connect to. Third trend I think is really, really interesting is that it's just getting really easy to build this stuff. Like, it used to be that you had to almost have a double degree in, like, computer science and electrical engineering in order to build some kind of hardware device, right? You had to be an electrical engineer to wire this stuff together, and you had to be a computer scientist to write the software that runs on that. And today, what we find is, with a little bit of training in computer science or a little bit of training in electrical engineering concepts, you could actually build some pretty cool devices. Some of the things I'll show you today deal with building on top of Intel's Galileo platform, which is a little Arduino-compatible board. Now, I'm a software guy, but I can plug some wires into the right holes as good as the next guy, and I can make some interesting devices as a result. I can also plug things into the Bluetooth port, and I can plug things into the serial port, and it's literally kind of getting that easy to construct devices. Of course, as you're building serious commercial devices, you need professional help. You want to build a custom board, et cetera. But to kind of get started and prototype, cost of entry is very, very low. So what all this is doing is this is making it easier for lots of people to play. And as lots of people are playing, if you just go look at websites like Kickstarter, as lots of people come and start playing, people are just inventing new scenarios. Like, wow, I saw this product that did this. I could tweak that idea a little bit, and I could create this completely new piece of hardware that does something totally different. And so it's creating a virtuous cycle of innovation in this space. And for companies, they're finding, wow, there's a lot of economic potential in doing this, either making my business more efficient or, in fact, helping me get into new businesses. One of the things I like to talk about, though, is there are lots of devices, and I'll actually give you some numbers in terms of how many devices and what kind and stuff like that. Estimates range up to 28 billion, 50 billion, 200 billion connected devices by 2020. I don't know what that number is. It's going to be a big number. It's going to be lots of billions of devices. But what matters is your things. You care about the internet of your things. You don't care about the internet of somebody else's things. You care about the stuff that's yours that you want to connect and you want to get value out of. Either from a consumer standpoint, like all the things that belong to you, you want to be able to reason about their data, you want to create rules that allow the devices to interact, or in a business context, you want to be able to acquire data from all of these devices and generate insights through that data. And some of the things we found, as I said, it's not a new space, and what we find is that people kind of come in, and when I talk to customers, sometimes they'll go, how do I get started? Like, do I need to buy a bunch of new stuff? Do I need to build a bunch of new system? And the fact is, generally, no. Like, in a lot of cases, you can start with the infrastructure you already have. It's probably good enough to get started. Adding more devices to stuff you already own. One of the great examples of that I find are things like smart city. A lot of people make noise about smart city, and it's a very exciting space. It turns out cities have been collecting data about how cities run for a really, really long time. Traffic light data, traffic pattern data, electrical consumption. Like, most municipalities have massive databases that have all this stuff already. So in many cases, it's not about how do I start collecting data? It's about how do I start getting data all in one place and then adding some new devices to get more data so that I can get better sense out of it. So a few things that I think are important ingredients to an IoT solution. One is intelligent devices, and that's what we're going to talk a lot about today. I'm always amused. Every few years, I think, you know, for those of you that have been in this industry for a while like me, every few years you kind of see people start talking about, the cloud is getting super powerful. Pretty soon, every device is going to be really, really stupid and a slave to some massive brain in the cloud. And, like, you know, we had this argument in terminal and mainframe days. All the data, you know, it's all in the mainframe, and we just have these dumb VT and Tektronix terminals. And then we had this argument again in the file server days, and then we had it again in the web, and then we had it again in mobile. And the truth is a little bit different. The truth is what happens is the cloud gets more and more capable, and endpoints get more and more capable. That's actually the reality. And so what you will find is both will unlock very interesting new scenarios. The fact that you're going to get nearly, or for all practical purposes, infinite storage and infinite compute and analysis capability in the cloud can enable you to do tremendous things, but at the same time, the fact that you have very, very powerful computers that can sit in your pocket also unlocks new scenarios. I mean, you think about things like speech and voice and natural user interface and things that really require lots of intelligence on the client. It's the combination of these two things. Now, one of the attributes of a great intelligent system is they act on changes in the environment. And they can interact with one another. So when the motion sensor detects that something happens, it has to be able to communicate that in a sane way that other devices can understand so that they can also go act on that information. And then finally, as I've talked about, being able to tap into that data, tying all of this together through the cloud. Now, as I said, there are lots and lots of smart devices. This graph is not drawn to scale, and in fact, I just made it up, but it gives you an idea, right? So the idea is that there are very few large devices, and one of the implications I make by this graph is that IoT is not just about, like, wearables and little tiny things. IoT is also about big devices, MRI machines, jet engines, things that are very, very large. Sorry, I've had a throat thing for a while, so you'll see me. In fact, one of the things I did learn from Steve Ballmer, I don't know if anybody's ever seen him speak. He'll have this honey thing that he drinks the honey, so I'm gonna try it out. If I start running around chanting for developers, somebody just put me in a straitjacket or something. All right, so there are more smaller devices than there are larger devices, and in fact, if I were to draw this into a pyramid, it kind of looks like this. This is how I think about the world of devices. At the very, very top, you have devices that have PC-like architectures. They tend to be x86. They actually tend to be based around PC motherboards. And they run Win32 applications, lots of different examples. MRI machines, thin clients, point-of-sales terminals, et cetera, et cetera. In the next tier down, you have mobile devices. So these are things that look like phones or that look like small tablets, like this. And I'll show you this kind of device in just a second. These tend to be ARM, but they can also be x86. And they tend to be touch first in today's world. Next stage down, you have small devices, which are kind of a diverse set of SoCs that are very, very low cost. They tend to have similar computing capability to phones, but a different chassis, and probably a more purpose-built chassis. Going even smaller, you have micro devices. These tend to be built around architectures like ARM's Cortex-M series of processors, microcontroller class processors. And this is where you find sensors, you find actuators, you find people building little robots that I'll show you in a little bit. Lots of very, very small devices, wearables. This device here, I don't know if you saw the news about Microsoft Band. That's what this guy is. This is built around a Cortex M4 processor, as just one example. And so if we go further down, what I would call nano devices, these are things that are maybe M0 class devices. And what's interesting about these devices is they generally don't directly talk to anything. They generally require one of the higher level devices to be able to communicate with the cloud or something useful. Now, I put some numbers up here. What you see in the numbers is these are millions of units of processors. So they're not millions of device units, they're millions of units of processors. And what's interesting about this is you'll find that nano's the biggest, but it turns out that many devices might have one big processor that is micro or small, and several nano processors to do measurements or actuation or that sort of thing. But these numbers also exclude things that you would call traditional computing devices. They don't include PCs, they don't include phones, they don't include tablets, they don't include game consoles. So what you're seeing here is really what we would probably call IoT devices and not traditional computing devices. This is our analysis at Microsoft. This is our estimate for 2017, so just a couple years away. And I would just kind of add these up, like over 8 billion devices in the lowest lane, 7 billion in the next, 1 billion in the next. It adds up to quite a few devices shipping on an annual basis. Now, if we get into intelligent devices, that's kind of what I wanted to start talking about, is Windows devices here at the point of impact. And if I take that pyramid and kind of map that to Windows devices, we have a product that sits in most of these lanes. We don't have an offering that sits in the nano lane. So that would be something that would communicate with one of these devices as an example. And we'll talk about demos for each of these. So at the top, we have embedded industry, and I'll show you what that looks like. Next, we have embedded handheld, embedded compact, plus some future offerings that I'll share with you today, and then .NET framework in the micro side. So if we just talk for a minute about embedded industry, embedded industry gives you basically a full version of Windows. You get a full version of Windows Pro with embedded industry, but you get some capabilities that allow you to tailor that experience to be some particular type of device. So everything it means to be a Windows computer, you kind of get in the box. And so you can build apps for it. You can kind of do the whole constructing line of business applications. But you can create a targeted device. You can create something that's not a PC. So let me show you one example of that. So what I have here is a little demo built in Visual Studio. It's a little app built in Visual Studio, and I'll set it up in this way. One of the things that we do when we build these kind of purpose-built things within our own team is we build reference applications. And so what I want to show you is a gamified version of a reference retail kiosk. Before I go to VS, though, I want to switch over and show you how I configure the embeddedness, if you will, of embedded industry, the ability to make this a purpose-built device. And so what I'm running here is a tool called Embedded Lockdown Manager. This is a tool that can control any computer that's running Windows Embedded Industry. And what it allows me to do is it allows me to configure it such that I can purpose tailor this machine to do exactly what I need it to do, but not allow people to have broad flexibility in how they use the machine. I just want to briefly walk you through the capabilities. And I know it'll be difficult to see the words from the back, so I'll talk about it so you don't really need to see the words. At the top, the thing I have selected here is dialog filters. So how many of you have been in this situation where you have walked through an airport, bus station, train station, and you see some brilliant, beautiful digital sign, and it's got like a Watson dialog or an antivirus dialog or some unfortunate Windows desktopness on there that kind of harshes the experience that it is a digital sign. Everybody kind of experiences this. That's because they didn't do this. So this is the way that you can build a digital sign or a kiosk without having these dialogues come up. And what it allows you to do is it allows you to kind of write some software, and then in this case I had the example I created was around the Notepad font dialog, where I can configure the Notepad font dialog. Whenever that dialog comes up, I can say, you know what, when that dialog comes up, I just want to automatically set the action to OK. I just want to immediately dismiss it and not let the user see that dialog. So it won't be a part of my user experience. And in doing this, you can kind of suppress all of the dialogues that might come up in a scenario where you don't want to see them or it's not appropriate to the type of device you're building. Similarly, you can also, not through this particular UI, but through console, you can also suppress toast notifications. Toast notifications for the operating system as well as toast notifications for the application. So you can really kind of get it tailored to what you want it to be. Now, for Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, there's also a gesture filter. So it might be that you don't want people to be able to swipe from the right-hand side to get the charms bar, or swipe from the top, or close an application by swiping it up, that sort of thing. And for this, you can control all of the gestures that are sitting there on the machine. Similarly, with the keyboard filter, you can control keystrokes so that if you don't want to allow keyboard input or you want to block certain kinds of keyboard input, you can do that as well. You can block the Windows key. You can block different key combinations. Now, there's two tools, a shell launcher and a Windows application shell launcher. These are the things that you would use to launch either a Win32 or a modern application as your shell experience. So this is how you enable your application to kind of boot directly into, or enable Windows to boot directly into your application and make that application the effectively the shell for Windows. Now, a couple more. One is the Unified Write Filter. Unified Write Filter is a great tool for public-facing computers, like a kiosk or a shared computer somewhere, maybe sitting in a public area like a hotel. What this does is it saves the state of the computer to however you've configured it, and every time the computer is restarted, it will go back to that very state. So people mess it up, people do stuff with it. The way you fix it is you reboot it, and then the computer goes completely back to normal. Really, really powerful, the Write Filter. And then finally, one more thing that I think is really interesting is the USB filter. I've heard stories of, for example, ATMs in the world getting hacked because someone was able to put a drive into a USB port somewhere, you know, behind a panel on an ATM machine. And the reason why that happens is because they didn't do this. What the USB filter does is it allows you to say, these are the only USB peripherals that I will allow connected to this box. And there's even a handy little feature where you can say, only allow connected devices. So you can kind of set up one instance of a device and get that instance exactly the way you want it and then say, yes, don't allow anything other than all the things I already have connected to this device. So with that, that's how I'm going to create my kiosk. Now let me run the app and let's talk about some of the code. And this app's going to start up and I'll show you what this does in a moment. Again, it's a gamification of a retail kiosk. I'm going to start the game, and the way this game works is I have a barcode scanner, and as things come up, I see it wants red and then it wants Orange. Oh no. Oh no. My barcode scanner. I'm going to lose. There we go. I'm going to lose the game. My barcode scanner is really not working well. What this allows me to do is kind of have a gamified experience for barcode scanning such that we can start collecting telemetry. And we actually have this kiosk in our hallway on our team. And when people walk by, they can kind of play this game, scan some barcodes, and let me get out of this game for a moment. Scan some barcodes and be able to generate telemetry that our test team can then use to make sure the system's working properly. I just wanted to show you a couple pieces of the source code here to show you how easy it is to get this thing working. First of all, you know, I've got a couple things here. I've got this barcode scanner, which apparently is on the fritz, but we'll try it again in just a moment. And I've also got a magstripe reader. In fact, I can take a credit card. I will just grab a credit card, and hopefully nobody's watching. I've got a credit card. I can try and swipe something with the magstripe reader. I'll show you that in just a moment. But if we look at the source code here, the APIs that we've made available for retail-style peripherals make this really, really easy. So if I just kind of walk you through here, what's happening is, I can go ahead and find all of the devices that are connected to my system. And in particular, I can look for a barcode scanner device, which if you look at the tooltip, it's in this Windows Devices Point of Service Barcode Scanner. It's a pre-built class. So I can say, hey, search the system. Find me all of the barcode scanners. Then I can iterate through this list and say, great, if I can find it, add it to my list of barcode scanners. And then I can simply set it up by saying, great, for each of these barcode scanners that I found, enable it to work asynchronously, go ahead and connect to an event that whenever data is received from the barcode scanner, go do something with that data, and then add it to the set of scanners that I want to be able to use. Likewise, I have code that looks almost identical for the magnetic stripe reader. Again, it's a pre-built class. I can just go ahead and say, yes, I want to go ahead and use that magnetic stripe reader. And then as data is received, I can do interesting things with it. Now, if we come over and look in here, this is the event handler for when the magnetic stripe reader receives some data. And in this case, most of this code here is just logic to kind of keep track of my game score, and I'll show you that in just a moment, provided that the barcode scanner is working properly. So in this case, you could see that I'm not actually doing anything with my credit card data in this case. At least, I don't think that I'm doing anything with my credit card data in this case. And then finally, I'll show you a little piece of code here. This is part of the event handler for my barcode scanner. And the one piece I wanted to show you here is how easy it is to compare. This is the thing that checks for equivalency between what is the thing that I just scanned, and in this case, it's a barcode representation of the word red, or the word green, or the word blue, and it just iterates through all of my potential targets and looks for it, and then does something if it finds a match. So we'll see. We'll give this guy one more chance and see if I can get my barcode scanner rolling. Or perhaps it indeed did die. Yes, dead barcode scanner. So there's the first demo gremlin. Not to worry, I have lots more demos, and they'll all probably go like this. So I hope you guys are having a good time. Okay, so let me switch back over. All right, so let's talk a little bit about handheld devices. Handheld devices are another category of IoT device. And you could see a few different examples here, and I brought some examples with me as well. Some of the attributes of these devices, one is they run Windows. So people can use Windows management tools with them. You can write apps with them like you write apps for Windows. We really optimize for line of business scenarios. So the idea here is we effectively take the retail version of Windows Phone, and then we put some special goodness on top of it that allows it to be used in a special form factor. So if I were to show you this device's form factor, for example, as I turn this thing on. So here is this device, And you could see this is kind of a Windows phone. Looks very much like the Windows phone that you know and love. The interesting thing about this device, though, is it's really, really rugged and durable. Like, you wouldn't do this with your phone. But with this device, there's no problem at all. These are great. Like, if you're on a oil rig in the, you know, in the middle of the ocean, this is the kind of device that you definitely want to have. But if you're not on an oil rig, if you're in a retail situation, this might not be the kind of device that you want to use. In fact, what we're finding from customers is increasingly, they don't want these big, expensive, ruggedized things for all scenarios. They want them for some, certainly. But what they want is they want to be able to use something that looks more like a consumer device. So what this is just a Lumia 930, typical device that you can purchase today. And what's interesting about this device is we've locked it down, this retail device, we've put the embedded Windows image on it. So that I can show you, I'm looking at this device now. And what I've done is I've locked this device down so that I can give it to someone that works in a retail store. They can do whatever they want to do with it. But I control exactly which applications run, exactly which settings are applicable, what the hardware buttons, in fact, do. I can prevent people from, you'll notice I can press the camera button on this device and it doesn't do anything because I've locked out the camera button. If I swipe over to applications, you can see that I have a limited list of applications here, and if I go to settings, you'll see that I only have access to a small subset of all of the settings that are available, only those things that I want to make available for the users of my device. So this is great if I am building devices for H&M or some retailer, and we want to be able to use these as business devices and not as retail phones. Sometimes we don't even want cellular capability. Perhaps it's only Wi-Fi. I'll show you one of the other things is this big device has a barcode scanner on the top, which is kind of cool. But increasingly what we're finding is that people can use the camera on retail devices as barcode scanners, and it works quite well. So what I've done on this application is I have a little barcode scanner here, and let me just, I've got my Purell here. There we go. And what it's doing is it's going out to the internet, it's looking up the UPC code, and there it is. It finds, based on the UPC code, it went on the internet and found the thing that I just scanned. So it gives you an idea that this becomes pretty easy, and in fact, useful when your laser barcode scanner breaks, you've got your phone camera, which makes it really, really handy. What I'd like to do is I'd like to show you some of the implementation for how I locked this device down. I really did a couple of things. One is I overlaid the Windows embedded handheld 8.1 image on the device. So I've got the right operating system on the device. The other thing is I provisioned it with lockdown. And if I show you this lockdown provisioning in Visual Studio, it's just an XML file. And if I walk you through a little bit of what this XML file does, at the top it says, okay, I've got this red laser application. That's the thing that I want to be visible in terms of all of my application tiles. And then in terms of the applications that are available, well, I've got calculator, I've got alarms, and I've got settings, and I want to make those applications available too. And then I have a little bit of XML here that locks down the buttons. You could see that search, camera, I'm locking out both the press and the press and hold functionality. And it's really that easy. It's very declarative. I set up this XML and then provision the device using this XML file, and voila. Then I'm able to use it as a tailored device rather than a consumer phone. Below that, I have some other housekeeping that allows me to create different user roles on this device so that if someone logs in as a manager, they can get a different set of capabilities than if someone logs in as a customer, et cetera, et cetera. All right, switching back over, now we're looking at the small class of devices. And today, people address these small class of devices with Windows Embedded Compact or the Windows CE code base. You see a few different examples here in terms of an electrocardiogram machine, and on the far right you see in-vehicle infotainment system that would sit inside of a car, and in the middle you see an industrial modular computer that would sit maybe on a factory floor. The advantage here is that these devices need to be highly customizable, so the operating system needs to be highly customizable. Things like security are very, very important. Things like real-time are relevant for these scenarios as well. What I'd like to do, though, is show you not a compact demo, but I'd like to talk to you now a little bit about what we're doing in the more in the Windows 10 timeframe, and that is bringing modern Windows to this class of devices. So let me now switch and show you this. Just curious, show of hands, how many of you have seen or know about this Intel Galileo board? Yeah, good number of folks. So I'll describe it just a little bit, and I kind of in real time built a little device here that mostly works. Let me get it all centered on the screen so I can kind of explain what's going on here. So a couple things I'd like to explain about what's going on here. One is this Galileo board is, first of all, Arduino compatible. So you could see on this board where I've got the wires plugged into on the top left and the top right, those ports are compatible with Arduino shields that I can just place on there and I can use those. The thing in the middle, you can see a little CPU. That CPU is about 5 millimeters by 5 millimeters. Within that 5 by 5 millimeter space is what 15 years ago we would have called a Pentium PC. A completely functional Pentium PC is sitting in a 5 by 5 millimeter square. That's a whole system on a chip. So controllers, you know, et cetera. Just above the CPU, you can see the RAM banks. There are two, both 128 for a total of 256 megabytes of RAM. And then bottom left, I've got a network cable plugged in as well as a little RC serial cable. That's actually a serial port. And then I've got power along the bottom, and that's about the grand tour of this board. Being able, now what's interesting is we have Windows running on this device, if you can believe it. This is what we would characterize as maybe an alpha version of where we're headed in Windows 10. We released this back around the April timeframe. We first started talking about this at Build. And then we've had a number of subsequent releases to improve our support, to add support for second generation Galileo. So if you obtain a Galileo, you can go to windowsondevices.com and you can run the OS image, the Windows OS image on these devices. What's cool is the way I program these devices is the same way that I program for Windows. So if I'm a Windows developer, that gives me most of the skills I need to then go be an IoT developer. And if I'm an IoT developer, I have the value of the Windows hardware ecosystem in building these devices. So one of the cool things about the fact that I'm running Windows on this device is above the serial port on the left, there's some USB ports. If I plug in a USB device, it's very likely to work because there's very likely to be a driver available, a Windows driver available for that device. So I kind of get this benefit of having the whole hardware ecosystem that supports Windows available to me on this device. Now let's look at a little bit of how we might program this thing. So now I'm going to switch over to Visual Studio again. Okay, and a few things set up here. A couple things I'll talk about just to kind of get you oriented. One is what this application does is it's an application that runs on my Galileo, but it uses a cloud service. It uses the OneNote cloud service. OneNote has this web-based application that you can use for note-taking, and there's a beta version of their API where you can go talk to that notebook from some other application using REST APIs, and then you can poke things into notebooks or you can read things out of notebooks. It's pretty interesting. So I thought what I would do is show you this little application. I will use it as my to-do list. The way this works is I have a OneNote set up in the cloud. I'll show you my OneNote that I have set up in the cloud. It looks like this. This is where my wife goes. My wife goes here and says, these are all the things I need you to do. And she types her to-do list for me. She could do this manually, but in my house, we really, really like technology. So she could type up this to-do list. I've got this great device here that will read those to-do list items from the cloud service. And there's a little LED light that I have plugged into the ports on this device that, or the digital I/O pins on this device, that will light up when there are to-do items waiting for me. So the light will light up. I then have a small printer. And let me show you the small printer that I have for this device. And the printer is the thing I was struggling to get working a little bit earlier, so we may leave out the printer part. But this is actually a retail receipt printer, and it's connected through the serial port. So this printer is the thing that's plugged in on the left-hand side of the Galileo to the serial port. So as I leave my house, I see the green lights flashing on my Galileo. I hit the button. It prints out a receipt of my to-do list. I could take that. I could put it in my pocket. I can leave, and then I could forget to do all those things, which is what I normally do. And my wife is really pleased when I do that. So now you kind of see the setup here. So let me head back over to my computer, and let me start just by walking you through a little bit of the source code so you have some familiarity with how this works. One is I have a URL at the top that I may have to hit. It turns out that because the OneNote API is in beta, the cookie that they give you to access the service is only good for an hour. So if it's been, you know, a little more than an hour since I've done it last, I need to go get another cookie. But we'll get to that in a minute. I've got some constants here that tell me which pins I'm using for the LED light and the printer button and the button that I can press that says, yes, I've done all these items. And most of the code, fascinatingly, if I use the correct computer, most of the code actually looks like Arduino's. In this case, it's C-style Arduino code. In the fullness of time, we will get .NET fully running on these kinds of devices. But right now, it's just C-style code. I'll show you a couple things, though. One is you can see that it looks a lot like the Arduino wiring API. So there's a setup function that gets called, if you're familiar with Arduino. Then there's a loop function that just kind of represents the continuously running state of your device. So the neat thing about this is that what we're trying to do is enable a world where you can take Arduino wiring code and just use it on this device running Windows. And you could take Windows code and just use it on this device and be able to mix both of these together, which hopefully that you would find that that's something that offers you some power and some value. So in the setup code, you could see that I'm just kind of configuring the pins that I'm using for the add-ons for this device. And then inside of a loop, I look to see, hey, has anybody pressed the print button? If so, I need to go print the contents of the OneNote. If someone said all done, then I need to go write a new page to OneNote to say, yes, this in fact is all done. And if items are available, I need to set the pin to the appropriate, or the pin that has the light to the appropriate value. That's really the bulk of the application. Now, there's a little bit of housekeeping in here in terms of, for example, how we print. You can see that it's kind of some raw serial type I/O here, where I open it up, literally a COM port at 9600 baud. You know, thinking old war games modems here, and just write things out to the printer. That all works really, really well. And then the other interesting piece here, just to show you, is the OneNote piece, which kind of, you know, as you look here around the center, I can open a notebook. I can then read what pages are available in the notebook, and I could see how many items are available on that page. That's the sort of capability that I'm looking to set up. So let me run this. So as I push run, you can see that I'm configured to use the remote Windows debugger. I have my computer here that I'm demoing on, as well as my Galileo, are sitting on the same subnet, connected by a hub. What we've built is we've built this application called Galileo Watcher. And what Galileo Watcher does is it shows me all of the Galileos that are available on my local subnet. And so I'm actually hitting the first one, which is called MS IoT Demo, as the first one, 36.244. And I want to make sure that I'm hitting the correct IP address. So if I go into my remote debugger settings, aha. So What happened is, while we were talking, somehow the Galileo decided it needed a new IP address from DHCP, and it managed to acquire one. Let's try this one out. This one seems to be okay. We log into it just like we would remotely log into any Windows machine. There we go, so we're running, looking for PDB files. You can see that within my debug output here, I'm outputting the contents, and you can see this looks like JSON data. It's just the contents that are coming and going through the OneNote service, so it looks like it's working okay. Let me head over now to my OneNote service, and I can just add some things to do. The first thing I need to do is I need to give an awesome demo, and then people will like it, and they'll applaud me, and then I will be famous. So that's my to-do list right now. As I come over back to my application and I take a look at what's happening on my Galileo. Okay, so now a little bit difficult to see, but there's a little LED light here that is now flat, that is now turned on, a little green LED that's turned on, difficult to see on the projector. Okay, great, that's kind of cool. Let's now see if my printing button has decided to start working. I'm going to click the print button. It turns out that in order for the print button to work, it needs to be turned on. I know, devices are finicky these days. So, printer's still giving me a little bit of grief, but what I'll do is I'll hit the other button, which is going to be an indication that everything is, that I've finished my to-do list. And let me head back over to OneNote here. And let's give this a moment. Usually it takes a little bit to refresh when someone else has done something. While that's refreshing, I want to show you one more thing, which is this idea that even though I'm running on this remote device, I can set a breakpoint. Even though I'm running on this remote device, I can set a breakpoint in my loop, and you can see that the breakpoint's hit, and I can literally do live remote debugging against this little piece of hardware, which I think is really an incredible, really an incredibly valuable developer tool. All right, so now we've refreshed, and the Galileo has created this new page called Status Update. And the status update got posted that said that I've completed the tasks that have been posted. Okay, that one's cool. So let's move on and let's talk about a different class of devices. Now I want to talk about these micro devices and the .NET Micro Framework. How many of you have heard of .NET Micro Framework? Just show of hands, a lot of folks. That's really, really good. Micro Framework is great for a few things. One is really good for resource-constrained devices. So while we worked really, really hard to get Windows in a smaller form factor to fit into 256 megabytes, .NET Micro Framework provides a small subset of the .NET API that fits in something that's as small as 64 kilobytes. Really, really, really tiny, maybe with as little as 128 kilobytes of flash storage to store the runtime and application image. So really designed for resource-constrained devices, small things that are very inexpensive to produce. Connectivity is kind of built in, so TCP/IP, sockets, cloud connectivity, all built into Micro Framework, and I use Visual Studio as the developer experience. And I just wanted to give you just a brief look at the developer experience. I don't want to linger too much on Micro Framework, but I do want to show you some of the things. One of the things we've done is built a cute little robot. So we've built this cute little robot here with a Netduino board. Netduino is an Arduino-compatible board built by a company called Secret Labs that runs the .NET Micro Framework as its runtime. And the way this little robot works is I've got the board drives the motor, which drives the wheels. And in the front of this thing, there's a little sensor. And the little sensor is able to tell when it's no longer reflecting off of a surface, when the light is no longer reflecting off of the surface underneath. So it will stop itself from running forward off of tables. Pretty handy. If I were to run this device, I don't know how interesting it would look on this particular Elmo. So instead of doing that, let me just take you over to Visual Studio and show you what would the developer experience look like for building this thing. So yeah, here we are. You'll notice a few things. Like typically when you build software for devices that are this small, you're doing it in some kind of embedded version of C. It can be very, very difficult to get that built out. In this case, this is all C#. It's .NET style development. I kind of have all the value that I get from a Visual Studio C# environment, but for very small resource constrained devices. This is the run function of this device that starts powering the wheels. And you can see that because it's C#, I get great IntelliSense, and I get all the things that I would normally get as a part of a great developer experience. Again, don't want to dive too deep into implementation of the robot because it's kind of a complicated robot. But on the other hand, I did want to give you the sense that I build this for a constrained device just like I would build software for larger devices. And in fact, there's a lot of source code compatibility as well. So the maybe libraries or software that I would write, components that I would write that would run on this device, I could build those same components targeting a larger form factor of CLR, and that would work just fine. One of the other things I wanted to talk about is a little bit more in the makerspace. So I've talked about, some of the makery stuff with Galileo. One of the things that we found internally as we were playing with this maker stuff is the Windows Phone makes a very interesting accessory for maker class devices. And so, as just some examples, I've got the full Windows API available to me on a phone. The phone has some pre-built functionality that does a bunch of interesting things. I can take advantage of both the hardware and the software ecosystem as well as the developer tools. I wanted to show you an example of that as I switch gears a little bit to a different demo. I've got a Lumia 530 here, which is just a little retail Lumia 530 device. In the US, I can get these for $50 to $60 without a contract. They're very inexpensive, but run a full version of Windows Phone. And we started thinking about, gosh, with this Lumia 530 device, what do you get? Well, I get a really powerful quad-core Cortex-A processor. I get a 4-inch multi-touch screen. I get a bunch of RAM. I get Bluetooth support. I get Wi-Fi support. I get cellular support. I have a camera. I have proximity sensors. I have accelerometers. I have a GPS. I have all these things that are really actually quite cool and capable. If I were to add all these up, for example, in the form of Arduino components or shields, I would probably pay something on the order of $260, something like that. But with the phone, I can kind of get a bunch of that functionality in a fairly inexpensive way. So one of the things I'd like to show is using the Lumia 530 as an add-on to some other kind of maker IoT solution. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show a car. Now, I have a car right here, not a full-size car because those are heavy, but I do have a small car. And I have a small car that this car, you can see by some of the pictures that are on the screen, there is a Galileo inside of this car. In addition to a Galileo, there's a motor to drive the wheels, and I've got a little breadboard thing with a Bluetooth dongle sticking out so that I can tether this car to my Lumia 530 just via Bluetooth serial connection, very, very simple. And essentially, we ripped out all of the old guts of this car and kind of put in all these new guts to be able to drive this car. I'll start by plugging in the battery for this car. It turns out that these batteries don't last very long when I use the vehicle in this way. And so it helps if I kind of put in a fresh battery when I'm ready to go and ready to demo. So I have a battery pack handy here. I'm just going to plug it in. Okay, good. Battery's in. Now we'll put the cover on the battery case. Good. Okay, so I've got this guy. All the parts seem to be okay. Now I'm going to switch over to Visual Studio. Okay. And let's take a look at the car. We'll start just by looking at a little bit of the car source code. Oh, thank you. You couldn't recognize that as car source code? That's weird. So just looking at a little bit of the car source code here, essentially what I do is I set up a few different commands. I want to be able to go right. I want to be able to go left. I want to be able to go forward. I want to be able to go back. So those are all commands that I've set up. You could see again that in this case, we're writing to an Arduino sketch pattern, which makes things really, really simple. There's a little bit of setup code that I do here where I assign particular pins on my Galileo board to be the motor driving pins that tell the motors to go left, right, backward, or forward. There's a little red digital LED that when the device is ready, the digital LED will turn red and it will turn on, which will be good. If we look at how easy it is to do Bluetooth, there's a little bit of setup involved, but basically, this is just stream reads from what is effectively a wireless serial port. So I'm sending one-letter commands from phone to device to say, you know, backward, forward, left, and right. Pretty straightforward. Let's take a look at the phone side of this. So now I have a different application, and this different application is about my phone. And so what I'm doing on the phone is I'm going to leverage the accelerometer in my phone to know when I'm tilting forward or tilting backward, tilting left or tilting right to be able to drive my car. It gets dicey to drive this way. But you can see how easy it is, for example, first of all, to set up and use the accelerometer inside of my phone. Built-in capability inside of the phone APIs to be able to access the accelerometer and do interesting things with it. What I'm doing here is essentially setting up the event handler that triggers when the accelerometer has some new data. And inside of that event handler, I can then go and I think that code will be over here. Inside of the event handler, I can go and then send the message via Bluetooth to the motors to go left, right, forward, back. And so you see here sending the command, pretty straightforward. All right, so let's see if this thing works. Wouldn't that be an interesting thing to show? So I've got my Lumia phone tethered here. And I am going to, and to prevent drastic injury, I think I'm going to hold the car. And as I hold the car, one of the things that's going to happen is the Galileo is going to need to boot up, and that's going to take about a minute and a half. So as this Galileo boots up, one of the things I wanted to do is go show you what this application looks like. So I've got this Lumia controller, and you can see as I lean forward, as I lean backwards on the device, as I go left, as I go right, I'm not connected via Bluetooth yet at this point, but what's going to happen is as I get this going, as I get connected, when I lean forward, it's going to send the one-letter command from phone to device to get this thing rolling and get it started. Now, one of the cool things about these boards is there's a little SD light. So you can see this SD light flashing as the computer's booting, and then when the SD light stops flashing, you feel pretty good about the fact that it's probably booted up by then. One of the things I was doing in my hotel room as I was getting this running and debugging the device is actually tethering it via a network cable And so it was kind of a weird scenario where I had a network cable kind of snaked into my car and talking to Visual Studio, and the network cable talking to Visual Studio was just kind of a surreal experience. Now, the little red LED on the front of the car has gone on, so I'm going to hope that that means that we're all ready to rock and roll. So I'm going to say connect. Now I should be connected. Now, as I go forward, ooh, there we go. Okay, and before I break something up here, now that I've showed you this, I'm not going to drive it live in the room here because I think that would be dangerous for all of us and I would probably break the vehicle. Oh, God. Okay. Damn. Okay, let's see if this works. It's going to be dangerous. I take no responsibility for any injuries. There we go. Maybe just an injury to the car. Okay. And I think I'm out of Bluetooth range now. Feel free to turn that guy off or catch him, do whatever. That's fantastic. I'm glad you guys encouraged me to do that. That was actually a lot of fun. Thank you, yes. Car crashes. I am the Thelma and Louise of IoT. I mentioned this website a little bit earlier, this Windows for Devices or Windows on Devices website. This is the place that you can go if you want to figure out. I actually have the source code for much of what I've showed you here, the car, the robot with .NET Micro Framework. A lot of the things that we've been working on, we've been doing in an open source way. And so you'll find, you know, source code, our Arduino sketches, our operating system images to run. You'll find all of that here. And then just a community to kind of join into and help out to build these devices. As things are today, the only board that we're supporting is the first and second generation Galileos. But you can imagine, in the fullness of time, we will have Windows images that run on a broader variety of boards and form factors. A couple things. I mentioned Uli Hohmann's session a little bit earlier, and that's something that you definitely want to check out if you have the opportunity. It was earlier this week, but certainly check it out on the playback. A couple links I would share with you. One is internetofyourthings.com, which is our commercial IoT portal, and then Windows on Devices, which is our non-commercial maker IoT portal. With that, I think I have a couple of minutes, about 15 minutes, to take questions. So are there questions that I can answer? Yes, sir. That's right. Yeah, so the question was, what about the real-time capabilities of this new form factor? You're talking about what we're running on Galileos, correct? And so today, this particular operating system does not have real-time capabilities. So for folks that require real-time capabilities, we still think Windows Embedded Compact is a great solution for real-time. What we do find, so there are a bunch of people that really do have hard real-time constraints. What we're also finding is the need for hard real-time constraints is less than it used to be when CPUs were much, much slower. There are some people that are building life-saving systems and that sort of thing where you absolutely want real-time. Embedded Compact is the right answer there. Other questions? Where can you buy the car? You have to make the car. That's part of the fun. It's called the maker movement, not the buyer movement. Yeah, you can hire somebody to build a car for you as well. Or if you pay me enough, I could lose it on my way back to Redmond. And anybody else? Any other questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a great question. So it was, didn't Microsoft announce support for some other boards, such as Shark's Cove, which is the Intel board? And yeah, you'll see us launch a support for a few of these boards. They're all a little bit different. So if I were to compare these, Galileo is interesting because it is Arduino compatible, but still x86, and we can run Windows on it and that sort of thing. So it gives you access to that maker ecosystem that Arduino kind of spawned. There's also a board called Minnowboard Max that we support running Windows on as well. Minnowboard Max is a little bit more like a small PC. It's got full graphics. You can basically power it. It's a low-powered PC. It's also a more expensive device. So where these Galileos cost something in the order of $60 US, the Minnowboard Max is something on the order of $100 to $120 US. So a more capable device, but also doesn't support the Arduino ecosystem, that sort of thing. And then sliding even higher up the sort of value complexity chain, Shark's Cove, which is another Atom-based board. Shark's Cove is really designed for somebody that's building a phone or a tablet. It's got all the right add-ins and all the right extensions and capabilities. If I were building a tablet, I would use Shark's Cove as my prototyping board to figure out exactly how I wanted that device to work before I went and made custom silicon for that board. And that one is more expensive. That, I think, is in the $400 range. But what's really cool about that device is it used to be that reference design boards for tablets and laptops were in the thousands of dollars. And so the fact that Shark's Cove offers that sort of thing in the hundreds of dollars is different. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question was, are we partnering with high schools and universities? We've done a bunch of partnering in the past around MicroFramework, and I expect that we're going to continue to do some of that. We're just starting this Windows on Devices program, it's something we're very interested in doing. I don't have any particular announcement to make right now, but partnering with academia is something we're very, very interested in doing. And part of the reason why we're coming and kind of showing up to maker fairs that have, you know, age ranges from 5 years old to, you know, 80 years old or 90 years old, you know, basically the cross-section of humanity comes to these maker fairs to understand how to build devices, and you'll definitely see us there as well. Yes, sir, I think. Yes? I don't have anything to announce right now on supporting for Raspberry Pi. I can say that Raspberry Pi is a really cool and interesting board, and it's something we'd love to take a look at. Yes?
If I understand correctly, that Arduino is Arduino compatible. So does this also mean that Arduino works together with the
Galileo board? Yeah, Netduino is in fact Arduino compatible. I can get two boards to work together through Bluetooth, for example, or I can tether them together with the serial port. They're two physically different boards, so you would need some means to communicate between the two of them. You can use Ethernet, you can use Wi-Fi, you can use Bluetooth, lots of ways that you can do it, but you can absolutely make them work together. And the code that you write for each of them is very similar in terms of the pin and wiring APIs.
Is
it possible to hook up the Netduino with Galileo? When you say hook up, what do you mean? It is. It is, yeah. And in fact, some of the things I've showed in the past are using a Netduino board with a Bluetooth dongle on it to communicate with phones and Galileo boards as well. So you could definitely do that. Yeah. Yes? Yes. Yeah, so the question was, what about other kinds of standards? Zigbee, Z-Wave, 6LoWPAN, lots of different wireless standards, particularly short-range, low-power wireless standards. Today, the way that this works is they typically come in the form of modules, either shields or plug-in modules that connect to the boards. So, for example, if I were to break this one out of the car and show you what it looks like. So this is the Bluetooth module for the car that you see sitting right here on the projector. Very, very small. It's, you know, about the size of my, you know, half of my pinky finger. And they make modules like this for other kinds of wireless protocols as well. I just happen to choose Bluetooth because it's supported by the phone. Yes, sir? The cost of the whole project, the car? So altogether, we probably spent, figure $60 for the board, probably another $30 for the motor, probably $20 or $15 for the Bluetooth dongle, a few parts, plus the car. I don't know how much the car costs, probably pretty cheap. I'm guessing less than $200 US for the whole thing, fairly inexpensive. With that, all right. Well, almost at the end of the conference, everybody. It's Friday, almost time for cocktails. I thank you very much for sitting with me this afternoon, and have a good day.